to omit some of the readings tonight because I'm very anxious to get right into the lead of Dawn. And she's a beautiful lady, and I'm very anxious to hear her side since I heard Peter's side this afternoon. Will you give Dawn C. from Reston, Virginia, a good, wild West Virginia welcome?
After that, I could just sit down and say. I looked at the clock and I said, an hour from now, it will all be over and I'll be sitting down and everything will be all right. No. But the truth of the matter is, it's all right right now. You know, you are very beautiful to look at. And I've experienced a lot of love this weekend. And it's not like talking before a group of hostile people. You've all been where I've been. And we share our experience and our strength and our hope. I'm very glad that we were asked to come here and share the good news of our recovery. It's been a privilege. I was overwhelmed last night listening to Barbara and how much she told my story. And then hearing those young people this afternoon was such a joy. I always think, what if I had found this program when I was 15 or 14 or however old, but I found this program when I was supposed to. You know, there is no time schedule. It came on time for me. I used to like to get up and I would start my story when I met the alcoholic. And I like to do that because it made me look like I was all sweetness and light. You know? That I was this lovely, wholesome little girl, you know, that came into his mother's house and saw him sitting there before a platter of food, and I said, that's the man I'm going to marry. It wasn't quite like that. About, oh, I guess 7 or 8 years ago, we had our youngest child. He was in therapy. He was having a very difficult time trying to get his life together. He was depressed and suicidal and in a lot of pain. And we were sitting one afternoon talking with the psychiatrist, and she said to Peter and I, she said, on a scale of 1 to 10, what kind of parenting did you receive? And my husband said, oh, I'd say on a scale of 1 to 10, I received a 1 or 2. And she looked at me, and I was sitting there as usual, looking very sanctimonious, you know. She said, what kind of parenting did you receive? And I said, oh, on a scale of 1 to 10, I would say I received a 8 or a 9. And she said, lady, you need to look at yourself. She said, no way in the world would someone who received a 8 or 9 marry somebody who received a 1 or 2. And so, on that note, my story begins, you know. I was born in a parsonage, you know, in Flint, Michigan. I was the last of 8 children. By the time I came along, my parents were no longer poor in the ministry. My father was doing fairly well. We moved by the time I was a year old to Detroit, Michigan. And he pastored a church that had, when he got there, about 200 members. And in the next 3 or 4 years or 5 years, he had built that congregation to between 3,000 and 5,000. It was just a marvelous congregation. Because they were so busy in their ministry, because they were so dedicated to their calling, they left me a lot to be parented by my grandfather, who was the caretaker in the home. And my grandfather, who I loved and worshiped, sexually abused me. And I didn't understand any of that until years and years later. My grandfather died when I was 6, and I mourned because there was nobody to take care of me anymore. The job then was turned over to my middle sister, who we used to call the Gestapo with bloomers. Yeah. She was angry because she had to take care of us. And yet, she was so needy in that home herself that she was willing to take that job without saying a word. And I think about it now, that young girl was 26 years old before she went on a date. She didn't go away to college until she was about 24. And I think they sent her away to college not because they were so interested in her education, but she was wearing out every rocking chair in our house. She just wouldn't move. She wouldn't do anything. She was so busy just taking care of us, and her life was passing her by. Now, I was not quite like my sister. When I was about 7 or 8, my father decided that in order for his career to advance, it was necessary for him to go back to college. And he would leave every Monday night after official board meeting at the church. And he would ride to Wilberforce, which is a college in Ohio, and he would go there, and he would be there until Saturday morning, which he would come home, have the service, and then he would go back again, which meant that after the death of my grandfather, then my father left. And I had this terrible feeling in me always of being abandoned, of being left. My mother was a lovely woman. She just said, and often, that she just really didn't like children. I mean, she was not a mean woman. She just said that she would never have had children had it not just happened. You know? I mean, when you grow up in a parsonage and there's so many things that ministers can't do, I guess that was the only thing they could do. You know, after 8, and my brothers and sisters used to say, I mean, you know, after you were born, you know, I mean, they just didn't want any more. I mean, there was enough, you know. Even as a little child, I was prone to dramatics because it was the only way I knew how to get their attention. I mean, I would do such things as standing on the porch as they were leaving to go somewhere and just literally falling off on the floor. I mean, I could fall from the banister all the way down just dramatically and letting myself go, you know, to see. Often, though, they would just walk by. You know, and I kept saying, you know, I'm here, you know. I mean, wait a minute, don't you know I'm here? A lot of things would happen in my life, and they just never noticed. I was a total failure in school. I mean, we're talking about a serious failure. They had so many problems because they didn't know what class to put me in. One year I would be in the class for all the brilliant children. The next year they'd switch me back to the class for all the slow children. The next year they put me back, you know, and they didn't know what to do. And they'd call my parents, and my parents would just, sometimes they came and sometimes they were just so busy they just couldn't get to the school. I'll never forget at one of my graduating from high school, which was a total embarrassment. My father was the speaker, and I could not make it with my graduating class because I had flunked gym. Very few people flunked gym, but by this time I was so big and so fat that I couldn't go to gym. They kept asking you to do things like take showers, and I couldn't cover myself with that towel. I had learned that if I ate enough, that I didn't hurt so much. I had learned that I needed food to stop the pain in my life. And I used food as an escape mechanism. That was the only way that I felt okay. I was about 18 and really very silly. I had never been on a date. Nobody came to call on me. Nobody. I remember once a fellow came by my house and he wanted to see me, and my father said, well, you know, I don't like his looks. And my brother said, look, anybody who comes to see her, whether you like his looks or not, you ought to let him come. We were talking about the girl who was going to be like her sister. But something happened that year. I discovered that I could sing. And that was a great miracle. When I sang, people listened. When I sang, and I only sang in church, something would happen. And people received something that was very beautiful, and I just loved it. The choir director at my church gave me extra lessons and extra attention, and I was delighted because it was the first time any man in my life that I could remember had been nice to me. On the way home from church, one choir rehearsal night, this man who was at least 48 or 49 or 50, I really don't know, took advantage of me. And I remember the pain of that experience, and the thing that I remember most was that there was nobody at home, and who could I go into and tell? And then I decided that maybe I shouldn't tell anybody. I can remember showering and showering, and my mother used to say, she'll wash the skin off of her. Why is she always in there showering? We went to Europe that summer, and on the way, I became sick on the boat, and I couldn't understand that. And they assumed that it was because we were seasick. I had never been on a boat before. And I just didn't talk about what was going on. I was so fat that nobody paid any attention to it, and neither did I. About 8 or 9 months after we came back from Europe, I remember one night when I felt life coming, and I didn't know what to do. I went for 2 days with labor pains and aches. I left one morning for school, and my feet were so swollen I couldn't put my shoes on, and I wore boots, and this was in April. And my mother said, Dawn certainly does dress funny. You know? My father had gone out of town, and I thought he would probably be the safest person to tell because I had to tell somebody. I went to the hospital. And I believe even before these programs that God loved me and was taking care of me, because I was standing trying to explain to the woman at the entrance place that I did not have a doctor. All I knew was that I was going to have a baby and I needed some help. And she was saying, well, where's the money? What do you have? You know, and there was one doctor who was standing there, and he said, I don't know anything about her, but she's going to be my patient. And he took me in. I gave birth to a 10-pound, 4-ounce baby boy. Now, the sad thing about that was that I was delighted. I had been abandoned all my life, and I had decided that no matter what, I now had a child. And I was going to shower on that child all the love and care and concern and joy that I had not received. They called my father from the hospital and said that they thought perhaps that he and my mother should stop whatever they were doing and come there for a change. They came. My father said, we won't talk about this. We will solve this problem. Everything will be all right. And I was delighted. This time, I thought maybe we were going to have some mode of communication and that we together would bring this child up. We got in the car to come home from the hospital, and we got to a stoplight. My brother and my sister, my mother, my father, and I were in the car. And a woman opened the door of the car and took the baby from my arms and closed the door of the car, and we drove on. My father said, "Get your life together." My father said, "Go back to school and get an education." My father said, "You have failed us, but you have a chance now. We're going to make things all right. Just get yourself together. Stop the crying. Stop the... You just have to understand life goes on." I decided, after months of searching, and it didn't work, I would go into churches and I would sit wherever there was a baby and I'd pull back the blanket and I'd look for the little line the way his hair grew to see if that was he. No. And then I finally decided that, well, what I'll do is get my life together. No. Now, there's a good end to that story. That in later years, my son was reared by my sister in a distant city, and that has been resolved as best it can be resolved. The thing also that was interesting to me in the level of my illness, that I never once thought of what that must have been to my parents. Of course, it was pain to me, but it was also a real shock thing for them. And they didn't know any more than I knew how to deal with that situation. My father was steeped in your reputation. He was a bishop by then in the Methodist Church, and you were supposed to look good. And how did it sound if the bishop's daughter had an illegitimate child? Things like that just don't happen. We're talking about 34 years ago. They just don't happen. Not in our family. I decided that what I would do was lose weight. And you see, the only thing that was wrong with me, it had nothing to do with the fact that I was in a lot of pain inside. The only thing that was wrong with me was I was fat. And I found a diet doctor. And the diet doctor gave me diet pills. And I went on a diet which consisted of eating watermelon and drinking black coffee. Occasionally I would faint, but you know, what's a little faint? You know, if you're going to look good, who cares about fainting, you know? It was that summer that dear Peter came home from the service. It was that summer that I walked out of my house a slim, attractive woman for the first time in my life. Now, we're talking serious attraction, you know. Now we're talking about, I would sit down sometimes on the front in cars with, you know, stuff, they were whistling, and I didn't know what to do with that. Nobody ever looked at me, you know. I mean, I had three young men ask me for my hand in marriage in 1 week, and I said yes. Each one of them, I mean, what do you expect, you know? Now, I looked at them carefully. One was a young minister who had an established parish and was doing very well. And he said, "What a great partnership we will have." and what a gift you will be to my ministry. The other one was working at the post office, and he had been there for about 6 or 7 years and had an excellent job and was doing well. The other one said to me, "I am an alcoholic." And lights went on. You know? I said, "I am home now." See, what I was going to do, the plan was I would give my life. To shaping him up. And at some distant time, I would see him standing in corners at some meeting or some place somewhere, and he would say, "I owe it all to her." And so we eloped. Why we eloped, I really don't even know. You know, I mean, there was no reason for us to elope. 2 years before, my mother had died of cancer. Very painful time in my life. And my father had said to me, "You know, Dawn, I have loved her as I have never loved anyone." He said, "You know, I will walk the rest of my life alone." And a month after my mother died, my father married again. You know, kind of. I understand now, my father didn't know how to deal with grief or pain or suffering. He didn't know how to go through any process. And so his way of stopping the pain was to get immediately in another relationship, and maybe he could avoid, just as he had avoided dealing with any of us and our situations and our growing up. It was much easier to minister to people out there. And as a child, I perceived that there must be something innately wrong with me, because he was doing good things for the world out there, and people were coming always to get advice from him. People were always coming to say what a wonderful person that my mother and my father were. And so, if they were so wonderful, then why were they not there for me? If they were so marvelous, then why could they not listen to any of my childish cries? And so I internalized early that there must be something dreadfully wrong with me. I looked with Peter because Peter represented something to me. First place, he was the first person I've ever known who listened to me. I was attracted to him from the time I saw him. I used to think maybe it was because he was so handsome, because he spoke so well. I was attracted to him because he was insane. And we struck in one another a chord. It was like two dingbats, you know. We eloped, and it was such a marvelous honeymoon. You know, they talk about the problems that you have within the alcoholic marriage. I think he had just come off a drunk that night when we went off in our wedding night was spent sitting in a hotel room. Oh, so romantic. We were sitting there, and I was saying to myself, "I don't have to be thin anymore. I got him." And he was saying, "I don't have to be sober anymore. I got her." And I said, "Bring those sandwiches." And he said, "Bring that drink, you know." And we're talking about the insanity began. We're talking about the insanity began. the self-centered fear, the pain, the promises. I remember one time when we were out and he said, you know, you don't seem happy. You said that you were so used to being lonely that if you only had somebody in your life, and you don't seem happy. And I couldn't explain to him, but you see, I didn't count on this. I didn't know that every weekend would be filled with alcohol, and I didn't know that I would be still sitting up here alone. And I remember sometimes he'd come back after being on a binge, and he would say, it's so nice to be married to a nice girl. He said, you know, I see all these women in the bars who are, you know, doing this and that, and I always know that you're going to be sitting there at home. And the thought went through my mind sometimes, I might even like to be sitting in those bars if that meant I'd get some attention. I was pregnant shortly afterward, and when that baby was born and Peter left me, that wasn't so bad, you know, that wasn't so awful. I think the humiliating part of it was that I had to call my father, and I had to say to him, in order for me to get out of this hospital, I need you to send the money to pay my hospital bill. I also think part of the problem was that I had fantasized that this time I was going to go through a pregnancy with somebody who was going to be there with me, and he was going to be there adoring this new child that was coming into our lives. And I realized that this was my child alone, and I didn't like that. When Lisa was about a month old, Peter went to AA. They came to call on him after his being away for 3 or 4 days on a drunk, and I had been crying that night, and finally I had gotten on my knees, and I said, God, I don't care what you do with him. I don't care how you bring him home. I am not going to rear Lisa in a home full of alcohol. You take him and do with him what you want, but God help me so that I can be a good mother to this child. Well, God had his own way of answering my prayer, because he came that night and Peter was so angry. I remember him hitting his hand against the wall and blood coming from his hands, and he didn't even seem to notice that. And he called for AA, and they came and got him, and I remember crying, but who's going to come and get me? Who's going to stop the pain in my life? And for 2.5 years, Peter went to meeting after meeting, night after night. And I saw less of him sober than I saw of him drunk. And women were calling my house. Folks, I was jealous. And I was sitting home once again, blown up like a balloon, looking like his mother. I don't mean like his mother looks, but you know what I mean. Looking old and tired. I used to wear a black dress for effect. If you want to know what pain is, I'll show you what pain is. If you can't tell it from the lines in my face, you will certainly know by how I look. And people would say, I used to have a prayer that let somebody know him from someplace other than Little Sam's Bar or someplace like that. And people were starting to know him from nice things he was doing. And I'd say, yeah, but you don't really know. Let me tell you my story. You know. I mean, nothing ever gets done around the house. I mean, nothing ever gets done. Things that have been broken forever. Every time we're together, he's saying, you know, I'm spending this time with you, but I'm really thinking about getting to a meeting or something like that. And I was angry because I wanted some quality time from somebody. Finally, I decided after times of going to a few open meetings with him that I'd better go to Al-Anon. Now, I didn't go to Al-Anon with good intentions. You know, I went to Al-Anon because the Al-Anon meeting met down there under where the AA meeting was. And I wanted to check those women out. You know, I wanted to know what was going on there. Why was it that my husband went to a meeting that started at 8:30 and came in at 1 o'clock? You know. Now, I would say that I perhaps was not the most pleasant person in the world to come home to. That's the understatement of the week. But I was there. See, my claim to fame was, but you see, I am a faithful wife. You know, I mean, I might be a mess. I might be unable to deal with, full of self-pity, anger, resentment, you name it. But I was a faithful wife. But also, nobody wanted me. You know, and I made sure they didn't want me. Because I was scared to death of men, you know. And so I had to stay fat so that nobody would make any, you know, don't look at me and see me as anybody attractive, because then I might not know for sure whether I would be a faithful wife, because he wasn't that great a husband, you know. I went to Al-Anon, and the group was very young. There were 7 women in the group, counting myself. There was one woman in there who was about my age, and she and I immediately struck it off. We were really great friends. She was sicker than I was, and I liked that image. You know? There were a couple other women in the group that really should have been in AA, because they came there to escape going where they needed to go for help. And there were a couple others who came a little after I got there and who I did my best to sponsor. Needless to say, they were in a lot of trouble. My friend and I used to talk in between meetings about things like, well, her plan was that she was going to go to the meetings in the back seat of her car and her husband's car, laying on the floor, so that she could check for certain that he didn't go home with other women and Peter didn't go home with other women. You know, I mean, this was her job. Now, you think that's insane, and I thought it was rather insane then because I didn't have the nerve to do it. We're talking about a sick group. We were really sick, but we were doing the best we could. Now, I'll tell you what, though, we only had one little book, and it was a little blue book that we read over and over again, and we read it within the context of, oh yeah, that's Peter. That's Peter. I can see him, you know. And I've got to tell him about that on the way home, you know. And I would read his big book to get the information so that I could share and talk the language. But there was also something that was very important. I knew that I was sicker in many ways than Peter was sick. I knew that there was something in me that was lacking. Peter talked about it this afternoon as the God-shaped hole, and that's what was present in me. There was this tremendous emptiness that I couldn't do anything about. I can remember even as a little child when my father would preach and they would open the doors of the church as they do in the Methodist church. Every Sunday I would run down those aisles and get on my knees and ask for God's forgiveness. And I don't even know where it was coming from then, because my eyes hadn't been opened to see myself clearly. I was empty. I always knew there was something innately wrong with me. It took me a long time of avoiding this program. I did everything I possibly could not to get into this program. I would go to meeting after meeting. Years passed, and God gave us 2 other beautiful children. I just couldn't hear. I was so afraid I was afraid if I ever looked inside of me that I would just evaporate, that there would be nothing there. And so I spent most of my life avoiding recovery. About 10 years ago, something else happened. Our middle child took us to a church. Our kids are seekers. They're beautiful children. Weird as hell, but they're beautiful. They're their mother and father's children, you know. Yeah, in the throes of my disease, I passed on all this marvelous information. And that I didn't pass on, their father was generous enough to give to them too. We went with her, and this lady at the church got up and talked about being a compulsive overeater, and she talked about her other ailment. And it was at that time I started dealing with the fat part of me. When I dealt with that part of me and cleared that part up, lights came on. I heard things at my Al-Anon meeting that I had never heard before. They had been said over and over again, and people in that group were still getting well, and I was still sick. I was the one that I would have given up on, but nobody ever gave up on me. We were living by then in upstate New York, and Peter had become a success in life. We had all the trappings. Our home looked good. The children dressed well. We all spoke well. Things looked fine, but inside I was in turmoil. And inside our home, there was a lot of pain because I was so insecure and so needy. I can remember walking the streets one night in upstate New York, and it was cold and it was rainy, and I was praying, God, let me be hit by a car. Let something happen so I can stop this pain. Someone suggested to me, why don't you pick up the 12 suggested steps? And miracle of all miracles, I heard them. I heard them. I heard them, and I looked at that first step and understood that after all these years of searching and pain, I was powerless. That I couldn't make Peter the type of husband I wanted him to be, and I couldn't make the children the type of children I wanted them to be. And by then, Lisa had left home and was suffering from alcoholism. And it announced to us that she was a lesbian, and we were in so much pain and turmoil, we didn't know how to deal with it. And for a little while there, we lost Lisa. But I began working the steps in my life. I began believing on a gut level that I could be restored to wholeness, to sanity. That I didn't have to hurt anymore, that I didn't have to live in the past, that I didn't have to have all those doors closed to me, that those same women who were getting well in those rooms were no better than I was, that God wanted me well. And I got under new management. I turned my will and my life and my choices over. I was able to take a fourth step as I had never done before. I was able to sweep back those corners and find that grandfather who had caused some pain in my life. And I was able for the first time to understand that I had been a victim young in my life, but I was a victim no more. I was able to give my fifth step. And I had given fifth steps before, but this time something happened. I felt the release happen this time. I understood that I was no longer alone, but that I was connected with you, and I was connected with my higher power as I had not been connected before. I was able to look at that sixth step and become ready for God to lift these character defects. I was tired, folks, of being in self-pity. I was tired of living paralyzed by self-centered fear. I was tired of being afraid of my shadow and afraid of you and everybody else. I was ready, and I could humbly ask. I heard something the other day at a meeting that just touched my heart, because I was trying to put in words, what is it that happens when we humbly ask those character defects to leave us? You know, we can't live without fear, because some fear is healthy. We can't live without anger, because some anger is real and it's necessary. We just have to let it go when it comes, because people like me have abused it too much. But the woman said at the meeting, she said, you know what happens is that we are transformed. That hate now becomes love. That fear now becomes faith. And it comes just in time. I was able to work that eighth step and work that eighth step and work that eighth step and make that list. And I was able to put me on that list and to put Peter on that list and to put those precious children that God so generously gave to me. About 4 years ago, Lisa came home. Lisa came home and I didn't know how we were going to handle that. Lisa came home, and not only did Lisa come home, she came home and brought a friend. Now, we're talking about a program that calls for unconditional love, you know? We're calling for a program that says that if you're going to talk it, you have to live it. And we were able to have Lisa come into our home. And Lisa used our home as a halfway house to get sober. And her friend got sober. And they celebrated 4 years of sobriety in July. Lisa is one of the most beautiful women I have ever known. God has touched her in such a way that she can carry the message as none other when she chooses to. She's a blessing in my life. And I have been freed up through this program to give her unconditional love as it was not given to me. But to give it to her out of freedom and concern and love, because that's what this program is about. Yeah. Alma, that's our other blessed child. I remember one time when Alma was so troubled. We were living then in upstate New York, and she was trying to get my attention, you know? And I was so caught in my own pain that I couldn't even see her. And I remember one time she came down the stairs, and she had painted her face in this grotesque mask. And she had these glasses on, almost like upside down, and she just was standing there as if to say, Mama, can't you see me? Don't you know I hurt? Can't you stop for a while and look at me? We got Alma to a doctor. And old Alma has begun to put her life together. But before she could get it totally together, about 4 years ago, 4 years ago was a tough time for us, Alma was raped on the way home from church.
this program made it possible for us to be there for Alma, to give Alma the unconditional love she needed so she could understand she was a victim, that she had done nothing wrong, that she was a victim, and to help her come to grips with who she is. Alma's a joy in our life, and she's putting her life together. I'm so proud of Alma. And God gave us David, beloved David. I remember when I brought him home from the hospital, and I remember looking at him saying, "Oh God, I have a son." David had a hard time. His father was absent all the time, and he had a hard time. About 4 or 5 years ago, David tried to kill himself. We had to have David hospitalized. David today is doing beautifully. As a result of these steps, we were able to put ourselves in the background and be there finally for David. He's still working on his story, but David is doing fine, and I'm so grateful for David. About 5 years ago, we were visiting in Detroit, and my sister said, "I think there's something I ought to tell my oldest son, and I think I ought to tell him that you're his mother." I was united with my son. It was all right because I didn't need him anymore. I had a higher power who loved me. And I felt so loved because of you people in these rooms that I could let him in and not need him, but just be there for him. And to let him know that he has always been loved and cared for. And I am grateful for him in my life. Peter and I celebrated 30 years of marriage. I only celebrated 15. Let's not be sick. Some tremendous things have happened in the last 10 years in our relationship. I began getting better, and our relationship improved. I began understanding on a gut level that I was all right, fat or thin, and that it was a privilege for Peter to have me in his life. And I began to understand that you teach people how to treat you. And I understood that through these rooms. There's certain behavior that is no longer acceptable, neither from me nor from him. We are in the sunset years of our life, and we deserve the joy of a relationship. And God has blessed us with that. I love him, and I'm so grateful for him. This has been a fascinating journey for me. One fraught with disappointments and pain, but with joy. There's a story I like to tell, and the story is about a man who laid by the road for 40 years. He laid by the road for 40 years in a lot of sickness and a lot of pain. And just a few steps away, there was a pond where he could have gotten up at any moment and gone over when the angels rustled the waters and he would have been made whole.
but he laid by the road.
And one day a man named Jesus passed by, and the man said to him, "Do you want to be well?" And this man who was laying by the road said, "Well, you know, I'd like to be well, but, you know, you got to get up. And you got to go over there to the waters, and there are people who are always going in front of me, and I just can't seem to get myself." And Jesus said, "Do you want to be well?" And the man who reminded me of me probably had some more statements and some more excuses, but finally, the question was asked him one more time, "Do you want to be well?" And the man said, "Yes." And Jesus said, "Pick up your bed and walk." Folks, I almost missed this program. I sat around meeting after meeting, year after year. And people would say, "Do you want to be well?" And I said, "Well, not yet. I mean, I'm not quite ready." "My agenda is this, you know." And they'd say, "Do you want to be well?" And I'd say, "You don't quite understand. You know, I want to be well, but I'm not certain I can let go of this anger and this resentment. I mean, you don't know what happened to me back there in 1952. And they'd say, "Do you want to be well? If you want to be well, you pick up these 12 suggested steps and walk. There's recovery in these rooms. There's joy in these rooms. I don't care what your problem is or how deep it is or how dark it is or whether you think you suffer from terminal uniqueness." In these rooms, you can get well. And if you don't believe it, the gift is given to us one day at a time. God bless you.